have to share that. So sometimes I'm compelled to break out in song when I'm in the middle of telling a story. For some reason, a song will come on. So when Maggie called to ask me to speak, she goes, "Under one condition, you don't sing." My name's Jane, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm so happy to be here, and I'm so touched by that introduction. Thank you, Maggie. And, yeah, automatically we had, like, this soul-sister connection because she's from New Jersey, too. And tonight I'm here via Tallahassee, Florida, which is where I live now. My home group is 909, otherwise known as Central Group. And I've been a member of that group since December of 2000. And I've been clean and sober. My date is September 24th, 1996. So this September I'll have 20 years, which I just can't believe. I mean, wow. I mean, you know, it's just when I think of what 20 years, it has just gone like this. And when I think 20 years from now, I'll be 73 years old. That really freaks me out. But anyway. And so I'm here tonight with my wonderful fiancé, James, who I hope you'll all go and support him. He's speaking at the Fifth Tradition Group tomorrow night. So we just had a really nice trip up here, and I really want to thank John Shires, for, John S., for inviting me. Where is John? Oh, yeah, there he is. I almost couldn't see because of the jacket. But really, thank you so much. It's always an honor to be asked to speak at one of these, and I know that any one of us in this room could be up here telling their own story, because we all have a story, let's face it. I just happen to be the one chosen tonight. I kind of like to think I'm commissioned by Alcoholics Anonymous to get up and share my experience and my strength and my hope with you all tonight. And part of the, you know, reason that I do this and that we all do it is because that's one of the miracles that the Big Book states clearly, is that each day, everywhere, somewhere in this world, one alcoholic shares their story with another alcoholic. And the Big Book always says that sometimes our dark past is our greatest possession, and that certainly has, with the passing of time, come to be true with me. And I always like to start, because I'll own it, I still get nervous, so I'd like to ask everyone, if you wouldn't mind, to bow your head and let's all say that third step prayer together. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, so that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. So, God promises all a safe landing, not necessarily a calm passage. And I'm really feeling God right now, being up on this altar. I'm getting the hint that I think I need to keep it clean, which is really kind of a bummer because it's April Fool's Day. And as a matter of fact, I'll just share a quick funny story. I mentioned my fiancé. We're in marriage preparation. I grew up Irish Catholic in New Jersey, so it meant a lot to me to get married in the church, in the Catholic Church. So we've had to do a lot of... We went on an engaged encounter weekend, and, you know, we had to meet the priests for an hour. We had our fourth session this morning, and he told us before we came that this morning's topic was going to be sex and finances. So anyway, I thought, oh, that's going to be great. When the priest will say, so how many sexual partners have you had? And I'll lay out the number, and I'll be like, April Fool's! And he'll never know. He'll never know. But anyway, I was born November 20th, 1962. And again, a big Irish Catholic family, one of five kids. My mom and dad have been happily married. They're going on 58 years. And, I know that when we're in these rooms, we hear these stories. We hear, like, the whole spectrum. We hear people who've had, like, really tragic childhoods, sad childhoods, sometimes childhoods that are sort of nondescript, and then sometimes childhoods that were just wonderful. And I am one of those. There's no reason on earth that I should have turned out to be an alcoholic. I had a loving family. My mom and dad were, just wonderful people. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. I'm really proud of my dad. He was a world-class runner. But to tell you a little bit about his work ethic, he actually was favored to be the first ever to break the 4-minute mile. And he missed it. He got a 4.00.08. But he still was a world champion miler. He was he was known as the first miler that ran for Villanova. And, but he, again, had this crazy sense of, discipline and, a work ethic. And no matter what, you work hard. If you want anything, worthwhile to happen in your life, you have to work hard at it, et cetera, et cetera. So, I grew up the typical daughter that wanted to please her dad, as did all of us kids. We all did. But it was really healthy when we were growing up. We had a lot of fun. He worked at a college, Manhattan College is where he was the track coach, and he had off all summers. So my recollections of childhood are really great summer vacations. And, really just a lot of fun, a lot of laughter. We grew up going to Mass every Sunday, and I felt like I always had a God in my life, I always felt like I had a relationship with Mary. And so, but I always felt like God was watching me, and it drove me to be a really good girl, my rebellion really didn't start. I went to a Catholic elementary school, had great nuns and priests, by the way, and went to an all-girl Catholic high school. Again, I had some of the coolest sisters that just really taught us to be leaders and outspoken and opinionated and have a life of service and do good things for other people. I really, loved the environment. I'm grateful for that, for growing up in that environment. But it was a private school, and actually I graduated in 1981. There were only 81 girls in my high school class. And one of the others in my high school class was Whitney Houston. And I always like to bring her up because I just like to, honor her a little bit. Plus, I think she lived in Atlanta too, didn't she, at the end? But I'll tell you something. And Whitney's another example of, like, we grew up with happy, loving families and homes. She was the all-American girl when we were in high school. She was funny, mischievous, always getting in trouble with the nuns, but really we were really innocent, It was like this age of innocence, even when we were in high school. So then I got accepted into Manhattan College, which is where I went, where my dad worked, which sometimes wasn't too convenient. I graduated second in my high school class, so I had aspirations of, going into med school, so I was pre-med. And of course, when I went to college, it was almost as if I was, this sheltered girl that lived in a glass house, and then all of a sudden I was let loose in the big city, and I went buck wild. And when I tell you I went buck wild, I am not kidding. It was like my first taste of freedom. All of my friends were raised, they were either Irish or Italian or whatever, but we were all raised the same way, and they were all going wild. So, hey, why couldn't I, too? So I just thought it was, sort of a rite of passage. When you're in college, you just party your butt off and get your work done when you have to get it done. And so anyway, I should mention, too, I had never really, I remember I got drunk. The first time I got drunk was when I was 14 years old, and I was with my older cousin, and we went to the movie theater. And I know this is another thing that blows my mind. It was the original Star Wars. That's like 40 years ago or something. But anyway, I remember you know, she brought in a bottle of rum and she just kept dumping it in our Cokes and stuff. And so I remember just drinking and watching that movie and just, you know, being like, whoa, you know, I mean, that was some movie to see on your first drunk, let me tell you. But I remember just flying around intergalactically, you know, sitting there right next to Han Solo on that Falcon Millennium, and, you know, and it was really cool because really it was very symbolic because it really took me out of this world and put me on a whole different plane, threw me into straight on into another planet, and I loved it until, of course, I got sick. And then I remember I smoked pot one time in high school. And I want to also say that I totally believe in singleness of purpose, but I also think that this is a part of my story, and I would be lying if I didn't talk about it, but pot smoking was a big part of my story too, as was cocaine, and I feel like drugs were always a great adjunct to my drinking. That's the way that I like to put it, you know. Alcohol was my one and only love. But it led me to do a bunch of crazy other things, like, you know, it led me to do some questionable things, you know, with guys, and it led me to spend way too much money on write checks for money I didn't even have, et cetera, et cetera. But often it led me to drugs too. So anyway, with that out of the way, I remember I smoked pot only once in high school. So again, I was really a good girl. College is when it all started. So freshman year, I again had those high aspirations. I remember freshman semester, I put on 25 pounds, and it was not the food, it was definitely the beer. And sophomore year is when I started doing some of the other stuff. And, you know, I went from being a really, you know, hopeful, you know, doctor someday, into this hippie chick, like, you know, I just changed my major to creative writing and French and, you know, and English and all that kind of stuff, and started writing poetry along the lines of, like, stuff Pink Floyd wrote, you know. But anyway, so I really had a great time, though, in college, but you know, it got me tired fast. When you think, I was in the 80s in New York City, where it was everything all the time. I'm not kidding you. And how I lived through that, I'd marvel. You know, because there's no way I should have made it out of that alive. But I did. And again, I think it was because of that crazy sick work ethic that my dad instilled in me. I mean, it was like, you're going to party hard? Well, then you're going to pay the piper the next day, but you better show up for whatever it is that you have to do. And I did that. I was really hardcore like that. So anyway, I want to fast forward. I remember it was junior year, and I was really getting tired of New York City and everything that it had to offer in the 80s. And I also was studying French, so I had an opportunity to go over to France. So I thought, oh, okay. And this was going to be like the first of my geographic changes. I'll go to France. I'll quit drinking. I won't be doing any drugs. I'll hang out with serious students. I'll definitely, you know, start with a clean slate and everything's going to be cool. Well, we all know what happened. I mean, I got over there. I lived with like a French family who had a 19-year-old French student living with her. She was wild. We lived in a town called Nantes, France, and we tore that city up just like I tore up New York City. And it was the same thing all over again. So, and then, but I'll tell you something, I was having fun, you know. Sometimes people in AA will say, oh, Jane, I think you were having fun. It's like, no, I was having fun. I was having a lot of fun. And so we went to, actually, that summer too, I backpacked through Europe, and that was my proof in the pudding that party people attract other party people. It was like I was a magnet for party people. I remember I had $300, and and we were going for almost 2 months, and I had my train ticket, which you know you could get your train ticket to anywhere through Europe, and I remember my first stop was Amsterdam. To, you know, to load up on the supplies for the rest of our trip. And then my second stop was in London to get my hair done. And by that time, the whole $300 was spent between those two things. But you know what? We still made it all through Europe. We had so much fun. We just slept on park benches, whatever. But again, party people magnetized other party people. That was for sure. And then I got back to New York to finish out senior year. I ended up, you know, dating like the biggest coke dealer on campus. My drinking continued to escalate. And you know, my intentions were, okay, senior year, straighten up my act, clean things up, I'm getting ready to enter the real world, I gotta stop dating these kind of guys, I gotta, you know. So anyway, but things just kept getting worse and worse and worse. I don't know how I did it. Actually, I do. I really still looked very innocent. You know, I always looked like I was very clean cut and sort of yuppie, preppy, and I always looked innocent. And a big part of my story is I was rebelling against the way that I was raised, kind of. So I always loved hanging out I loved to shock my mother. Like, I remember one time I brought home this guy, I'll never forget his name, he was from Colombia, and his name was Jorge Aristizabal. He spoke no English. He had like a Fu Manchu mustache and hair down to his butt. My mother was like, and then I remember also, I was thinking about this today because we were listening to some old ZZ Top, like from like 1971 or something. But I remember then this other guy, I must have been, I don't know, but he also had the long hair and he was a biker guy and he picked me up and I just kind of, I might as well have had a Catholic girl, schoolgirl uniform. That's how I looked, you know, and I hopped on the back of the motorcycle and we went off to see Molly Hatchet. You know, I remember like all these like, and I had this, like, I just was attracted to, like, the biker subculture. I was attracted to the punk rock subculture. I just, you know, everything that I wasn't, I was attracted to. But I think that came, too, from my mom, who was very judgmental, and I wanted to show her that I was not. I loved everybody. I didn't care what your color was, your status, your... So I just went, like, crazy at trying to prove that. So my first year of teaching, I started teaching high school. I got a job teaching high school. And I lived in Hoboken, New Jersey, which was across the river from the city that I love so much. But Hoboken was a really cool city, too. Little did I know how conducive that was to continuing my party girl lifestyle. I don't know how I taught high school in the condition that I was in. Well, yes, I do, because I had a lot of chemical substances to help me through it. But I mean, I would like stay up all night, go home, shower. You know, I remember having like, you know, I always drank vodka in the mornings because it always, you know, they said it didn't smell. You know, vodka and cranberry, whatever. Yeah, right. But anyway, so that's when I started. That's when like I started to. My family started to notice that I had problems. You know, I never even thought about alcoholism or anything. I just thought I was just a party girl. I was getting it out of my system. One of these days I was going to, you know, I had it under control. One of these days, whenever I, you know, met the right person, I would stop. But forget it. I was the quintessential party girl, and I was off to the races, you know, in my mid-20s. And my family started to pull away from me. I got my first DUI. My mom disowned me. My brothers and sister were like, Jane, you know, we were all crazy when we were in college, but, you know, something's going on with you. You got to stop. And I just, you know, I didn't want to listen. But it's still, I didn't think I had a problem. I thought I had it under control, or I could stop anytime I wanted to. Well, anyway, I started, when I was teaching high school, I started to do things that that I said that I would never do. You know, like I started to cross all those lines that I said I would never cross, very slowly but surely. And this, a lot of this had to do with my morals. But, you know, I remember I always chose drinking men, and I would become incapable of acting in a way that would preserve my dignity. So as a result of having, you know, like semi-consensual sex or whatever, I would just drink because that sort of diluted the guilt that I had and the discomfort, and it sort of made that whole phase bearable. But it was really, like, that was one major line, my morals. Then I remember I had a relationship with a married man. I would never have done that, but I thought, oh, well, he doesn't have kids, and, you know, he's leaving his wife anyway, all that, and, you know, anyway, stuff that I thought I would never do, but alcohol sort of, you know, encouraged it or made it all okay. And anyway, I got into I felt like I was getting into this hole, and the only thing that would dig me out is another geographic change. So a friend of mine who I was teaching high school with had worked over in Japan, had a year sabbatical, and so he just came back and he said, yeah, you know, they're interviewing for Japan. You should go teach over there. It's really cool and fun. It was 1988, so Japan was booming. So anyway, I got interviewed, got the job, and 2 weeks later, I was on a plane to Japan. And I remember the guy on the plane was sitting next to me, and he's like, wow, that's pretty courageous. You don't speak any Japanese? And I was like, yeah, I know how to say domo arigato, Mr. Roboto. And that was about it. And I knew Saki Tumi. So anyway, I went over to Japan, and let me tell you it was off to the races again, because I was hanging out with crazy, and I mean crazy, Brits, Canadians, New Zealanders, Australians. These guys were nuts, and these gals were nuts too. And when you're in Japan, you could do anything and not get arrested when you're a foreigner. And that's what we did. We got away with, I mean, it was crazy. So I went for a year, and I ended up staying for 3 years. And it was really, you know, it was a lot of fun. Until it wasn't. And in Japan is when I did some really cool stuff. I traveled a lot. But my job was really conducive to drinking. I taught Japanese businessmen who were about to be shipped overseas, and they had to be immersed in an English course. So I was staying at a training center like Toyota for a month with the same guys, eating breakfast, lunch, and dinner with them, and every night drinking with them, you know. And for them, it was like a vacation because they have a very regimented lifestyle and, you know, it's all about work. So for them, every night was like a party. So, I mean, I kind of wish, like, when I'm doing my AA talks, I kind of wish there was a projector behind with, like, movies and pictures of it. I mean, every single picture I have in Japan, I am completely bombed out of my mind. But having a lot of fun, but anyway, these guys, they were a trip. Some really good cultural exchanges went down in the evenings while we were doing all of our drinking. And those Japanese guys can drink, too, let me tell you. But anyway, that's when it started to wear on me. So I was in my late 20s, and I remember just being really tired, and I remember this is when I started drinking in the morning, because I could. I mean, it would be like I would have a drink, and then a Bloody Mary or whatever, or a vodka cranberry, and then go and teach, and then at lunch have another one, and then it's because it was like this make-believe land, like you could do that and get away with it. All of my friends who were teachers were doing that. So again, it kind of normalized it, which is really kind of crazy, but it means that we had a whole bunch of alcoholics that were expats over there in Japan in the 80s, but I remember getting the shakes. That was the first time that it ever occurred to me that I might have a problem, you know? So, and I always share this story too, just because it was after 3 years, I had decided to go home, because of course I still had the image of finding this great guy and getting married and having kids and, you know, pick the house with the white picket fence, all that stuff. Because I was, after all, approaching 30. And I remember my friend, recently I visited my friend Keta over in London, and she had kept a journal. And she cut out this page and gave it to me, and it said, my friend Jane decided to cut back on her drinking, which means she didn't drink for lunch on Thursday. So that's when I kind of really started, you know, like, looking back, I knew that I had big problems, but I was in this weird sort of denial, or I still thought, anyway, okay, fast forward, moved back to New York. And things just, I thought my family would have welcomed me back with open arms and everything would have been okay because they missed me. But they were just disgusted because, I mean, I remember in Japan there's like a 14-hour difference. So at like 3 in the afternoon here, I would be bombed calling my mother at 5 o'clock in the morning like, hey, Mom! You know, and she, so I did that a lot. So so anyway, they were just really scared and nervous and very standoffish and did not welcome me back. And what did that do? It pushed me away even more. It's like, oh yeah? Watch this. You know, you guys are my family, but my real family are these people down at O'Donnell's, down on the, you know, like that kind of thing, like at the Cheers thing, you know. And so anyway, that's when I really started to realize that I had a problem. I got, as I said, I got a DUI, and a friend of mine had, and I knew I needed to get away from everything in New York, everything, that relationship, all the other relationships, all the alcohol, all the drugs, all the, I mean, the same faces. I had to move. So a friend of mine had a restaurant down in the Keys, and he's in the Florida Keys, and he said, you know, why don't you come down here? You can waitress. You can ride your bike everywhere. So I had this great idea. Okay, I'm going to go down to the Florida Keys and try and get clean and sober. Yeah, right. That didn't work out too well. As a matter of fact, I'm going to keep this short, but that is where I really hit the skids. That is where truly the incomprehensible demoralization that the Big Book talks about happened to me, and it hit me right square in the face. You know, I remember, you know, my drinking heydays, you know, always having like a bottle of Stolichnaya in this freezer, and you know, having like 3 Stolichnayas on the rocks before I would go out on the dance floor or whatever, you know, and cocaine, whatever, you know, I mean, an 8-ball on a Friday night was just wonderful, you know, and so glamorous, and cocaine and champagne. In the Florida Keys, it got down to like drinking out of a bottle of Popov. You know, I weighed like 105 pounds, and I started smoking the stuff that I used to snort. And I kind of went on like a road to self-destruction. You know, it was almost like a suicidal run because my family didn't want to have anything to do with me. I felt I didn't have a job. I was couch surfing. I just felt like the biggest loser in the world. I was always in a constant state of crashing, and I just didn't have the nerve to kill myself, so I just thought I would go down in flames, you know, like, you know, whatever. So anyway, I had that proverbial moment of clarity. I looked at myself in the mirror. I didn't know the woman I saw. I know it sounds corny, but that's exactly what happened to me. I really didn't know the woman I saw, and I called a cousin of mine who was living up in Fort Lauderdale. And she had a bunch of young kids. I can't believe she did this, but she let me go and live with her and sort of start to, you know, just to try and get my act straightened out. And to make another long story short, I ended up doing just that. I got a job in Fort Lauderdale. I met a guy. He was actually living in Europe at the time. But he was really cool. He had like I was working for a big travel agent, and he had like a love for ex-adventure tour packages. So he did really cool stuff like bicycled through Europe, rappelled glaciers and stuff like that. So he came down to Fort Lauderdale, and he wanted to go down to the Florida Keys to check out the water sports. So we ended up, you know, going down to the Keys, and even though I was like, not feeling great about it because of my, you know, just, it was a dark place for me. The first tiki bar we hit in Isla Mirada, we started drinking. We did that all the way down to Marathon, and which is like the middle of the Keys. And so we went, we watched the sunset down by the old 7 Mile Bridge. And then that night, a friend of mine was playing at a bar, so we went and, you know, saw my friend. And then I had this great idea, like, let's go back down to the 7 Mile Bridge and watch the sun come up. So that's exactly what we did. And I remember when we were going down the bridge road, I saw this one sign that said, authorized vehicles only. And I was like, oh, well, vehicles, let's just go for it, you know. And I remember thinking to myself, this is weird. This is just kind of a bridge road. I wonder where it's leading to. And all of a sudden, we went like around this little curve, and it was just like, bam! This thunderclap, this bolt of lightning, everything just shook me to my very core. And I was like, oh my God, where did that come from? Where did that come from? And I remember Max was just quiet, and I remember I opened my eyes and I looked at him, and he looked like he hit his head and he passed out. So I started shaking him, and I was like, Max, wake up, wake up. How are we going to get out of this? And then I remember I put my hand down to my ankle, and I lifted up my hand, and it was just covered in blood, and I had just felt the bones in my ankle. I mean, it was horrible. And then my left knee hit the dash, so it was like my whole left side was just jammed up into my stomach. What happened was my pelvis just completely shattered. And the pain was like, it was unbelievable. And I was just like, oh my God, how are we going to get out of this? How are we going to get out of this? And then I realized after several minutes that Max still wasn't coming out of it. So I just started to shake him and shake him and shake him. And it didn't take too much longer to realize that he wasn't breathing and that he was dead. I hate this part. And I remember, just saying my prayers. I knew that every breath that I took was a conscious effort, that I was probably going to die too. And actually, I was wishing that I would, because I knew all those thoughts were going through my mind. How am I going to live with myself? How? Because of me, this beautiful life is no longer here. This is too much to bear. God, please take me too. And it must have been several hours, but I knew I was on my last breath. And I remember seeing the blue lights coming up behind me. And I just remember that police officer, and he was just so nice. And he just kept saying, please hang in there. Hang in there. We're going to get you out of this. And I remember I was just screaming for Max. And I was just screaming for God to take me to. And then the next thing I remember is I got put onto a helicopter and I got flown to University of Miami Hospital, and that's where I remember the first thing that I remember when I came to was my dad looking at me and one of my brothers. And the first thing that I said, the first words that came out of my mouth were, Dad, it didn't happen because I was drinking. And I'll never forget the look that was on my dad's face. It was just like, oh my gosh. So anyway, I hate crying, so I just want to get through this part. So I was in the hospital for 5 months, the regular hospital for 5 months, and then I had to go to physical therapy and I knew the legal stuff was coming down the pike, and I knew it was bad. I had not one DUI, I had two DUIs. The second one was, it was a DUI, but anyway, this was my third, and so I was looking at 15 years in prison. And, I talk about the legal stuff and I talk about the physical stuff, but I'll tell you, there's nothing like the emotional stuff. So I went to my first AA meeting when I was in the hospital, and I remember this whole thing actually almost split my parents up, because my dad, who I thought would have been the one that was like, she made her bed, let her lay in it. He was the one who really came to my side and was like, this is our daughter. And it was my mother that was the one that was so ashamed and angry and mad. That, you know, how could you do this to me? How could you do this to our family? You're going to give Daddy a heart attack. You know, you're bringing shame upon us. We have, how dare you? Shame, 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 you know. And so my dad was the one who was my backbone for everything. My mom just kind of went away for a while. And my brothers and sisters were really upset too, but they showed me that they loved me and they cared about me, but they couldn't put themselves through this pain anymore, so they were very standoffish. And so anyway, when I went to my first AA meeting, it was when I was still in a wheelchair, and I remember thinking, and my dad told me if I didn't do anything about my drinking, then I could kiss the family goodbye. So I went, and I remember thinking, oh my gosh, I have to go to these meetings, really? You know, I mean, I just wasn't getting it. And then after 5 months in the hospital, I moved to St. Pete Beach, Florida, and that's where I really got sober. And I was only allowed out of the house to go to physical therapy and to go to an AA meeting. So I went to an AA meeting at 7 a.m. every morning, and those people really saved my life. I mean, really saved my life. Can you imagine? You know. I was looking at 15 years in prison. I was physically, you know, very, very disabled. I broke my neck at C1, C2, by the way. So it's a miracle that I'm alive. And it's a miracle that I'm not brain damaged and I'm not paralyzed. C1, C2 is the same that Christopher Reeve had. My ankle was severed. My pelvis was smashed. I mean, a whole bunch of stuff. But it required a lot of physical therapy. But during that whole time, my AA friends were bringing me, and after my 7 a.m. meeting, they'd bring me to physical therapy, and I'll tell you, those people saved my life. And most importantly, they were telling me things like, there before the grace of God go I, that could have been me. I used to drive drunk in blackouts with my four kids in the car, and, you know, things like that. And for some reason, it just made me feel better. I don't know, it just, you know, it made me feel like less of a freak that other people were doing crazy things too. So anyway, I got sentenced to 5 years in prison, followed by 10 years of probation. And I did it, and I know I could stand up here for the next hour and tell you all about prison. Lately I've shared with some of my friends, one of my biggest resentments these days is that I didn't write Orange is the New Black, because I really could have. And then I tell people, you know, my family must have had a family meeting, because they did not make it easy for me in prison. You know, prison, like you see in that, canteen is everything. Well, my family did not send me a penny. My mother was like, you think I'm heavy sending you money so you can drink Coca-Colas and eat potato chips in prison? I don't think so. You're punished, and, you know, that's it. And so she didn't, and they must have had a family meeting, because none of them ever sent me money. So it was very humbling, because I had to use, like, the state toothpaste, the state shampoo, all that kind of stuff. I never had, like, you know, any of the stuff that you see. So it was funny, because I always thought maybe the name of my book would be I'm Nobody's Boo, because I'm a broke-ass bitch. But anyway, prison was really something. I really met some of the finest women that I've ever met in my life in prison. I was really blessed, because I had a really good service thing going. I taught, because I was a real teacher. I was a teacher's aide there, so I started a literacy program my first 2 years, and then my last 3 years I helped women who were trying to get their GEDs. And then I got out of prison. Well, actually, let me talk about prison a little bit, because that's where I had my psychic transformations took place. I had a few of them, but one of the first ones was Easter week. And I remember I went to confession, and the priest was, you know, young guy. He actually looked like Jesus. He had the beard. He was probably about 30. He looked like the Sacred Heart of Jesus, you know. And so I remember I was telling him my confession, and then after confession, I looked up, and his chin was trembling, and he was shaking, and I was like, oh, look at the priest, he's crying. And then I realized he was crying, but he was mad. And all of a sudden he said, Jane, if I could, I would pick you up by the collar, I would throw you up against the wall, and I would slap you silly. I am so sick and tired of you confessing the same sin over and over again. Every month I hear the same thing. You know, do you think you're too great to, like, accept God's forgiveness? Every month I tell you, you're forgiven. That sin is thrown out there into the sea of forgiveness, but you keep reeling it back in and reliving it. It's like you like living in that state of unforgiveness. Well, do me a favor. Until you forgive yourself, more importantly, until you redeem yourself, don't come back. And I was like, what? Whoa. But it really got to me. And it was that like brick in the head that I really needed to hear. And I started to change. I started to really change inside those prison walls. And I started to really experience freedom inside those prison walls too. And any time, it taught me really that any time that I was having problems, even in prison, it was because I was placing my will between me and God. And that's the story of, like, my whole problem with God. It wasn't God, it was my will. So anyway, the other one was another priest who happened to be from New Jersey, came in and said Mass once a month. And so after Mass one day, he said, ladies, I just wanted to share with you, I talked to the warden, and I'm an alcoholic in recovery, and I asked if I could do fifth steps, and the warden okayed it. So I was like, wait a minute, this priest from New Jersey, and he's doing fifth steps, and I can do a confession and fifth step, and, you know, kill two birds with one stone. Yeah, sign me up. So I did. And I'll tell you, I got really, I did a really thorough job that first step, that first time that I did my first fifth step. And he was very loving and caring, and he's still one of my really good friends today. And I'll tell you, this was really cool too. I was in prison in Florida. When he would go home to New Jersey to visit his family, he would go and see my mom. And it really helped my mom, you know, understand alcoholism. And it also helped her to on her road to forgiving me too. So I'll be forever grateful to him. Okay, so then let me just talk about my, I talked about what I was like, what happened. Now I'll start to talk about, you know, current things, good stuff. So I got out of prison, 10 years probation. I'll never drive again. I lost my license. It's lifetime revocation with no chance ever of even a hardship license. And I'm saying that because you know how when we're all at meetings, sometimes newcomers are like, I lost my license for 6 months. What am I going to do? I can't believe this. You know, whenever they get somebody that says that, they send them my way, and I have a little sit down with them, you know. And then also I had to go to a meeting, an AA meeting, every day. Even my probation officer was like, I have never heard that before. 10 years probation, you have to go to AA every day? And I was like, I know. Can you believe this? I mean, I'm trying to build my... but then I am so grateful. Actually, I'll share really quick. This is another one. There's so many miracles of this program. It's unbelievable. But this one is a pretty cool one. So somebody was listening to my CD down in the Florida Keys, and they figured out, oh, my gosh, it must be the 20th anniversary of her accident. So this was just in November. And so the woman who was my hostess actually worked for the court system, and she knew my judge, the judge who sentenced me. So she told the judge, you know, she said, you're not going to believe it. Do you remember the girl that was in the accident? And she's like, of course I remember. That was one of the hardest sentences I had to bring down, because I knew, you know, I knew that she was a good person, but it was really hard. But, you know, there was a death involved. I had to do it. And so anyway, she said, well, we're having a gratitude dinner do you want to come? And the judge came to the gratitude dinner. You know, James actually met her too. And she was just so happy. And, you know, you have to think, like, judges, they don't know what happens sometimes, you know. It must be such a great feeling when you see somebody that, you know, your sentence really worked for. So I kind of made some jokes about it, though, like, AA every day while she was there, and she was just, you know. But I did it. And then after 5 years, I went back before her, and I was like, okay, I'm trying to rebuild my life. I'm going to school full time and doing this and that. And when the gavel came down, I still had to go 5 days a week. She took 2 days off. So, but I'm really thankful, and I got to tell her face to face that I believe she really saved my life, you know, by doing that. That's what I needed, and somehow she knew it. And my first job at, well, anyway, the first time I, when I got out of prison, I had my hefty bag with all my stuff, and I was going to, I remember I went to, first stop was the beauty parlor to get my hair done, but I remember in the car, in the taxi cab, I was, this song started playing, and I couldn't believe it. And maybe many of you know what song it is, because I think Larry Scott is from around here, from Lynyrd Skynyrd, but they were playing Freebird. And I had just gotten out of prison, like literally 5 minutes before, and I mean, I'm in the back of the cab crying. The cab driver was like, "Are you okay?" I'm not going to sing it, Maggie. The cab driver was like, "Are you okay?" And I was like, "I'm fine. I just got out of prison." And he was like, "Are you kidding?" And he cranked it up really loud. So I started singing. So anyway, then I, after that, I got my hair done, and first stop was 909. And sure enough, at the meeting were the girls that used to bring the meetings into my prison once a month. And they were so cool. It was three of them. They were funny, and I remember thinking, I want what they have. And sure enough, when they saw me, they were like, "Oh my gosh, when did you get out?" And I was like, "Today, like 4 hours ago." They were like, "Oh!" So that was like a sign that that was my meeting place. And, you know. And by the way, if anybody does prison stuff, I always like to give a shout out to you, man, because that was like the light of my month. So thank you for the, you know, the work that you do with Alcoholics Anonymous in the prisons. So, okay, I know I have to speed things up a little bit, so I'm going to tell you what all the miracles that have happened since I got sober. I got out, and I got up. My first job was as a housekeeper at a hotel, and I quickly got promoted to the front desk, making $7 an hour. And I'll tell you something, that was the best job I ever had. And I remember whenever I went for a job or anything, I would look people dead in the eyes and I'd say, "Please give me this opportunity. You know, where would any of us be without forgiveness?" I never lied or hid it or whatever. I always was straight up with it, and I found that that was really effective. I know that a lot of people took chances on me. It was almost as if every corner of this journey, I turned a corner, there was an angel there waiting to help lift me up. So I ended up, and then I thought, well, I'm in Tallahassee, Florida. I tried to get my teaching certification back for the state of Florida. The Department of Education was like, "You will never teach again, forget it." And I was like, okay, well, what else can I do? So I applied for the College of Social Work. I figured, well, I'll dedicate the rest of my life to love and service. And went to apply, and I got turned down because of my felony the first time and the second time. And finally, the third time, my letter landed in the right hands. And this woman, who is now one of my best friends, but she was the assistant dean at the time, she heard my story. We both started crying. She said, "Not only am I going to give you a scholarship, but not only am I going to accept you, but I'm going to give you a scholarship too." So I had an assistantship. The only thing I had to pay for in graduate school were my books. I mean, what a miracle. How the heck does that happen? And so I worked full time, went to my AA meeting every day, and went to grad school at night. And I did that for 2 years straight, and I got my MSW. And I also stayed very connected with the college after. And I worked for the first job that I got, which I had to go through waivers for with the Department of Children and Families because of my felony, but I wasn't taking no for an answer. I just kept trying and trying, and finally I got the waiver. And I worked, my first job was working at a detox, and then on the crisis stabilization units at the psychiatric hospital. So I loved doing that. Then I got another job at night to get my supervision hours to become licensed at the Addiction Recovery Center, where I helped with counseling sessions for addicts and alcoholics and their families. It was just great. I mean, all these wonderful things started happening. And then a lot of really cool stuff started happening, but like I said, I just want to start to wrap it up. But my dean at the college, after 5 years, one time called me, and it was really cool because my brother was going through a rough time with my nephew, and I was out visiting in Houston when I got the call. But the dean of the College of Social Work called and asked if I would be interested in a full-time faculty position. I was like, what? Of course. Oh, my gosh. I mean, can you believe it? It was like less than 10 years ago I was sitting on a prison bunk, and now I'm going to be like an adjunct professor at Florida State University. I mean, a full-time professor at Florida State University. It's just it's almost too much to comprehend, you know? And I was very connected with Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to, because I don't drive, I live very close to the AA house. I went to my meetings every day. I was entrenched in the program. I sponsored a lot of women. I mean, it was like, it was proof in the pudding that you just keep doing the next right thing and great stuff keeps happening, you know? And I still struggle, you know? I mean, I think that that's part of my Irishness, or, you know, I'm just stubborn and I get very resentful when things don't go my way. And so I got this prayer from a really cool nun named Sister B. Maybe some of you know her, but I say this prayer when it's to free me of the resentments that I so often get, and that I still, after all these years of working the program, have to really pray about this character defect. But I say, God, help me to look with soft eyes upon those who are part of my days. Break through my barriers of scrutinizing views. Transform my inner landscape into a peaceful place of acceptance. Pull back my projections and my criticisms. Replace my mean measurements and my biased expectations with an openness that allows others just to be. Cleanse me of everything that clouds my perceptions and blocks the sunlight of your spirit. So, of course, my life isn't perfect. I've had some rough times happen. I actually am a survivor of breast cancer. When I was at the Florida prepaid, or the Georgia prepaid, I had just finished my radiation treatments 5 years ago. So that's a good sign. 5 years of cancer-free. Yay! But I've also had some difficult times. I was, terrorized by a stalker for 11 months, and he was a former student of mine, very, very mentally disturbed, and it was not a love stalking, it was a hate stalking, and eventually he took his own life, but it wasn't before really terrorizing me for like 11 months. And then my a previous boyfriend I have an injunction against him right now. So there's been some really, weird things happening too in my life, but I always have the 12-step program to help me through it. I always like to say that, whenever I stumble on this path of life, I know that the 12 steps are, that the answer is just 12 steps away. I know that that life lived with this precious, life-giving, life-sustaining, life-saving gift of sobriety is the most precious gift that I have. And I have to nurture it, and we all know the ways and means by which we have to do that. It's all in service. There's so much more that I wanted to say, but go off in tangents every once in a while. But I do want to say that for all of us, for everyone who's here, if you're an alcoholic, an addict, a loved one, whatever, that it's never too late to become the person that God meant for us to be. And I know beyond the shadow of a doubt that I find happiness even in the adverse things that happen to my life. There's a reason for everything. And how cool is it that now we all have a second chance at life to do the things that we thought we would never be able to do? It's like we all have this big, massive do-over, if you will. And as we go through the day, we pause. When agitated or doubtful, I simply step back, say a prayer, and ask God for the right direction. I try to practice the principles in all my affairs. This starts to happen just if you keep doing, the program. It just all of a sudden magically starts to be who you are. A lot of it is very, very, happens at a very unconscious level. But I know that it's a program of honesty, and I take that really seriously. Rigorous honesty is, to me, one of the greatest gifts of this program. I know that a new life has been given us. If we follow these principles, this is what happens. We have faith instead of despair. Courage instead of fear. Peace of mind instead of confusion. Self-respect instead of self-contempt. Self-confidence instead of helplessness. We gain the respect of others instead of their pity and contempt. We have a clean conscience. My favorite, instead of guilt, real friendships instead of loneliness. And I always try to remember, thankfully, everyone who helped me when I needed help, and I pray that that I'll always be there to do that for other people. The biggest blessing in my life right now, as I mentioned before, is James. And I've never been married before. I don't have kids. And at the age of 51, I found the love of my life. And at the age of 53, I'm getting married for the first time. So, I mean, it's just been wonderful. Oh, thank you. And I'm so thankful that this is another gift of sobriety. And James has 32 years of sobriety. And he lives a life of service like I've never met anybody before. I've never met anyone as entrenched in the program as James is. And he is from the Chicago area, and was able to experience his home group. It's unbelievable, AA in Evanston, Illinois. And he sponsors a ton of guys. And I just can't believe this is happening. But he's really the finest man that I've ever met. And I just can't wait for this to happen. And we're having a big, happy wedding, and it's going to be a lot of fun. It's July 30th, so if you're thinking of us on July 30th, we appreciate the well wishes. And just remember, everyone, the privilege of a lifetime is being just who you are. I forget who said that, but I think it's Carl Jung. And I want to just close with the 12-step prayer. Dear God, my spiritual awakening continues to unfold. The help I have received, I shall pass on and give to others, both in and out of the fellowship. For this opportunity, I'm grateful. I pray most humbly to continue walking day by day on the road of spiritual progress. I pray for the inner strength and the wisdom to practice the principles of this way of life in all I do and say. I need you, my friends, and the program every hour of every day. This is a better way to live. Thank you so much.